这个位置那儿镜头里面问题的地方，以后的后的问题嘛。
Yeah.
Now this is February 24th, 1961. This is a little story by Tom Long Jr. And this is Harry Hughes recording for Igloo 4, Pine Hills of Alaska, at Fairbanks, Alaska. Now Tom, will you start out and give me where you were born first, and then the members of your family, if you know your father and mother's names and where they were born, and then how many brothers and sisters, and on down your early life first, and then how you come to Alaska.
Well, my father, my name is Thomas H. Long, Jr., 1034 6th Street, Fairbanks, Alaska. My father came into Dawson in 1898 along with two brothers, John Long and Les Long. The three brothers mined one winter. On what creek, I don't know, out of Dawson. Now, Les Long returned to the States, and my father and John Long stayed another winter. Then my father went outside in 1900, and he married my mother in Salt Lake City, Utah, Susie Long.
What was her maiden name?
Susan Timoney was her maiden name.
In Salt Lake City?
In Salt Lake City, Utah. Then in 1903, they went to the Philippine Islands, and my brother was born in Manila in the Philippine Islands, Donald McLean Long, in 1905. Then from the Manila in the Philippine Islands, they went to the Isthmus of Panama, and I was born on the Isthmus of Panama, a territory like Alaska, in 1908. My dad was in the canal construction there. Then in 1911, we came to Oakland, California, where we resided. And then in 1912, my father returned to Alaska and went to Ruby, Alaska, on the Yukon River as a Deputy United States Marshal. He was there for 3 years by himself, and then in the spring of 1915, my mother and my brother and I came into Alaska, into White Horse. And from White Horse down to Dawson, and we stayed in Dawson 1 month, waiting for a boat to go down the Yukon River. That was too early in the spring. The breakup wasn't over with. To get the first boat going down the river to Ruby. So we landed in Ruby the spring of 1915. I don't remember what boat it was, no. But I remember that we had to stay in Dawson a month, rented a cabin, and stayed there for 1 month.
What was the town like
there? Well, Ruby at that time was a big town. It was a mining town. Ruby itself isn't a mining town, so it was a supply center on the bank of the Yukon River for the mining district, which were laid out in back of Ruby. There was the first mining of any importance started 28 miles out in back of Ruby, which is Long Creek, not named after our family, but the creek is Long Creek. Then you had quite a few creeks there bearing gold in that area. Then you continued on out another 28 miles to Poor Man, and in between Long Creek and Poor Man was all mining area. Ruby at that time had four or five grocery stores, at least four or five saloons, had a newspaper, had a drug store, had two or three practicing lawyers, and two big hotels. And on out in Long Creek, they had a couple of saloons, good-sized hotel, a bowling alley, which was quite a little city in itself.
Yeah, bowling alley in those days?
Bowling alley, well, not at that time, 1917, but a little later on. Then in Poor Man, the town itself was, I wouldn't say was ever as large as Long Creek, but there was a lot of people on Poor Man. You could go out to Long Creek and look down the creek as far as the eye could see, and you'd see nothing but boiler house after boiler house, you know, different workings, different claims. And there was a lot of work in those days. Everything was done by teams, had lots of horses. All the wood for the boilers was hauled by horses. All the freight to the creeks from Ruby, where it was landed by boat, was hauled to the creeks by horses. Big teams of horses, matched horses, expensive horses. Then they also had fast horses and buggies for passenger service from the creeks to Ruby. And the boats, everything was brought into Ruby by boat in the summertime. The end of navigation, why, that was the end of any freight coming into Ruby. You had all your eggs and flour and sugar and everything was brought in. Stores would have a big stock, and you'd buy by the case, or you'd buy 100 pounds of flour or 100 pound sack of sugar. You wouldn't go down to the store and buy a couple of dollars worth of stuff like you do in this day and age. You'd buy a case of eggs or take it home. You'd have to turn the eggs over, candle the eggs, hold them up to a candle, see if they were see-through them or not, if they were dark or the egg was rotten. And you had to turn the eggs, because if you didn't turn the eggs, well, the yolk would settle to the bottom of the inside against the shell, and that caused the egg to spoil. And as a boy in Ruby going to school, I went to school with, I'd say the school was about two-thirds white and one-third native children attending the school.
Indians?
No, not Eskimos, Indians. No Eskimos, they were Indians. Teacher had come in from the States. In fact, my dad went outside one summer and brought in a teacher. It's hard to get teachers to come into those places in those days sometimes. And it was very rare that I had a teacher 2 years in a row. We'd get a new teacher nearly every year. And all 8 grades in one room. Some grades, there were no children in at all. Like, say, there'd be some in the first grade and some in the third grade and fourth grade and maybe no fifth grade. Just happened on the ages of the kids going to school. And all classes in one room and one teacher. Well, they taught the same subjects that they did now, writing and reading and arithmetic and history and geography, and just depended on what grade you were in, what subjects were taught in those grades. But I'd say that the kids in school at that time were taught very well, because the teacher had time to give each kid individual attention if he needed the attention to help him along. And
about how many pupils did the teacher have at
that time? Oh, I'd say maybe it all depended on a lot of times where the native kids, where they'd go out, their folks would go out trapping, where they'd go out trapping and miss school, you know. The white kids would be generally in attendance every year, but it would fluctuate up and down as to how many kids the teacher would have each year. But I'd say maybe she'd have 20 or 25 with all the 8th grades. There weren't too many kids in the town in those days. And Ruby at that time, it was a good-sized town, bustling town, lots of activity in the town. Then the 4th of July, when I was a kid there in Ruby, they'd take up a collection all over the town, donations, 4th of July celebration, and it surprised you the amount of money that they'd collect in a donation of that kind, because everyone would give, and they'd give freely. And they'd have sack races for the kids and egg races and tug of wars for the men and weight lifting contests for the men, and celebration to go on and contests half a day. We'd have a big dance. We had 2 halls there at that time, 2 big community halls. Well, they had the don't know, the Moose Hall, Big Moose Hall, and they had the Pioneer Hall. And they'd have their dances. Natives and whites would dance together, intermingle. There was no discrimination of any kind.
All out to have a good time.
All out to have a good time. Free music, free orchestra. People that knew how to play would play. They'd get tired playing, why, two or three more people would play. Dance would go on all night. Maybe if they wanted to have another dance, they'd dance the next night, two or three nights straight. And I remember when I was a kid, I used to go around the town with a megaphone, like they used to have on a Victrola, you know, well, to call through. And I'd spiel up and down the streets in the town what was going on at the picture show that night.
Town crier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd get a free ticket to the movie and a dollar for spieling all around the town what was going on at the picture show. And I used to carry newspapers. I had a...
That was a newspaper company, Fairbanks?
No. The local. We had a newspaper in Ruby. I can't remember the name of the newspaper, but I remember that I used to peddle the papers. And 25 cents was the smallest piece of money that you ever saw. We never had pennies and nickels and dimes. We never had paper money either. It was all silver and gold. Fives, tens, twenties, two and a half.
Did you use $50 slugs too?
Hmm?
Did they use $50 gold slugs in those years?
$50 gold pieces? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, not so much. Not so common then, you know. I don't remember that so much, but I remember the fives and tens and two and a half and 20, most commonly used. But I remember.
Was a $10 gold piece was called an eagle, and a $20 gold piece a double eagle? Was that what they called them in those days?
I think so, yeah, I'm not sure.
I remember a little myself.
Yeah.
And the $50 slugs were generally square, looked like a little brick. They'd be stamped in the side.
I don't remember that coin so much as I do the others. And like the kids in, at that time, if they wanted to run an errand, they'd hardly ever run an errand for less than a dollar. Kids had more money in those days than I ever saw kids have since or at any other time. I mean, you made money. Kids made money.
All through these years, your father was working as a deputy marshal.
He was deputy United States Marshal in Ruby. Then, in 1920, my mother and my brother and I went to the States because my brother was ready for high school, and there wasn't any high school in Ruby. So we went to the States, and we went out by boat. We'd already come down the Yukon from Dawson in 1915 to Ruby, that part of the Yukon River. Now in 1920, we went by boat.
What part did you
leave? Well, wait a minute. I'm going to go back before 1920. I can remember at Tanana, Alaska, which is above Ruby on the Yukon River, they had Fort Gibbon. And like people in the summertime where they'd take excursions, you know. And there was Horner Hot Springs, which was about 12 miles above Ruby, which was a beautiful place. Natural springs, hot springs. And there was a roadhouse there. And it was kept open winter and summer. And they heated the roadhouse with hot water. And the lady that, Mrs. Horner, that run the hot springs, she grew vegetables of all kinds, and berries, and had chickens, and had rabbits. And people would go up to the hot springs on a weekend from Ruby by boat in the summertime, and by dog team in the wintertime, and stay a day or two and return home. Or they'd take a trip up to as far as Tanana in the summertime. They had Fort Gibbon up there, and at the time of World War I, well, that's where the young men of they were going to war, while they were assembled there at Fort Gibbon and then shipped out from there by boat on down the Yukon River to St. Michael's and on by boat on out to the States in the Army. And I remember all the boats they had on the river at that time. It was not uncommon in Ruby to have two boats tied up at Ruby and see one going upstream and see one going downstream.
They were river boats.
They were river boats, stern wheelers.
Why did they transfer to the deep sea boats?
At St. Michael's.
St. Michael's. These people come
at St. Michael's, and they went out on the old Victoria was on the St. Michael's Seattle run for years and years and years and years. An old boat on that run. And that was the boat that we went out on in 1920 was the Victoria from St. Michael's to Seattle. What boat we went down the Yukon River on from Ruby to St. Michael's, I don't remember the name of it. But I remember the names of a lot of the boats. There's the Seattle number 1 and 2 and 3 and the Hannah and the Julia B and the Sarah and the Susie, double stackers, and the Reliance. And one of the largest boats that ever came up the Yukon River was the Isom. In fact, I think it was the biggest boat that ever came up the Yukon River. It made one trip. They claimed that it burned all the wood that was cut on the river in that one trip. Such a big boat pushed so many barges.
Do you remember about the wood camps where they stopped the fuel?
The wood camps? Yeah, that was an industry. Industry in itself on the Yukon River and also on the Tamnaw River where our boats plied. Because all these boats were wood-fired boilers, and they generally have at least one or two boilers on the boats, and it required a lot of wood. And men up and down the rivers would have camps and put up hundreds of cords of wood where the boats had stopped and load on wood. They'd stop, and maybe they'd load wood for 3 or 4 hours, load the boat, maybe put some onto the barge. Besides, it all depended on how far they'd have to go to the next wood camp.
Well, was it customary for the passengers to help load wood?
Sometimes, sometimes, but not common. Mm-hmm. But if they were short in a crew or something, well, maybe they might do that, but it wasn't a common thing for them to do it that I can remember. Then, at the time in 1920 that my mother and brother and I went to the States, why, in St. Michael's we had to wait 3 weeks for the boat from St. Michael's to Seattle, the Victoria.
Wait for the DC boat to come
in? Yeah, come in. And we rented a cabin there for that 3 weeks' time. And my mother cooked and kept house, just like she'd cook and keep house at home in Ruby, waiting for this boat. And my dad followed the family out in 1921. Then from 1921 to 1926, we were in the States. We were in Oakland, California, and Los Angeles, and Kirkland, Washington. Tried the chicken business in Kirkland, Washington, and for a couple of years, and all the chickens we had several thousand laying hens where they contracted the chicken pox and lost a lot of chickens, and my dad gave it up, and we returned to Alaska in 1926. And I've resided in Alaska practically ever since, myself.
See, I remember those chicken ranches because I was selling water systems to those people when they first had pumps and automatic floats to feed their chickens. That was one of my jobs. I sold and installed that water systems to these different farmers. I used to visit with these chicken ranches.
Yeah, and then these chickens, I remember we used to have to wake them up in the morning with electric lights, and then we'd put them to bed at night with electric lights, with dimmers. The lights would gradually dim like the sun would be going down. That was to give the hens a longer day in the winter time.
Lots of rainy weather and cloudy weather, and the chickens don't lay.
Yeah, and you'd give them a longer day, too, to keep them up. And they were force-fed all the time, that is, for egg laying. You fed them dry mash, and you fed them wet mash, and you fed them grain. And we grew kale. That's something similar to cabbage leaves, but it's, you know,
it's
it doesn't come to a head.
It.
It's a greens for them. And we fed them kale for greens, and shell, and charcoal, and sour milk. Everything that was used to for egg laying, they were the white laying.
You remember the Averys, the bee ranchers down there too?
No, I was never around a bee ranch.
Around 1925 and 6, there was a lot of bee ranchers up in that country.
Well, Kirkland, Washington was pretty heavy for chickens at that time. Yeah, right. The reason we went there was because I had an aunt there that was in the chicken business, and we settled near her.
Well, you should remember the Kirkland Ferry, then, Captain Anderson.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, the old ferry, Lincoln. And, Kirkland wasn't much of a town at that time, but it's quite a town now, just like...
Rose Hill District was that district lived in.
Oh, yeah, Rose Hill, yeah, about halfway between Kirkland and Redmond.
Yeah, that's Rose Hill
Rose
District.
Yeah, Rose Hill District, yeah, you're right. And then you had Houghton, the shipyards, just below Kirkland. And you had Bellevue. Bellevue's a big... There's been a big development in late years in Bellevue now.
But that's the pontoon bridge across from Seward Park. Oh, yeah,
that was in later years. That was in later years, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we returned to Ruby and returned to Alaska in 1926, and my dad returned to Ruby as a deputy marshal. And,
About this time, what were you doing for a living?
Well, in 1926, I went to work for the old Alaska Road Commission, and it was under the War Department at that time. I was born in 1908, so I was 17 when I first went to work for the Alaska Road Commission. And I worked on the Richardson Highway when it was just a trail, and I worked on the Circle Highway practically from the start. I can remember when we used to have to be pulled our trucks across the 12-mile summit by horses. Hook a team of horses on ahead of the truck and pull you across the summit. And the trucks that we had in those days were the old Model T Ford and the old World War I GMC trucks. They were built and made for the government in World War I, but these trucks had never been used. By the government, so they were sent up here for the War Department for road work. And those were the trucks that we drove. Then and later on, a few years later on, well, we got the Model A's.
Didn't some Dodge trucks get in here too, Dodge cars?
Well, not very many. Dodge cars, yeah, but we never had any Dodge trucks. We had the old Model T's and the GMC's, mm-hmm. which were made during World War I.
Well, what kind of equipment did you use to clean the roads in the way of blades?
In the way of blades, they had Fordson tractors with a belly blade attachment that they used to use. And then they used a drag, a three-way drag, too, that they dragged behind. And
they'd weight those down so they'd cut
weight them down so she'd cut, yeah, and cut on the road. It was a three-way cutting edge that they had on this drag, and they'd pull that on the road. And they had the old 30 best tractor. And they had the 60s, the old 60s. And all the machinery at that time had to be cranked. You had to crank it by hand. Fords and tractors, the old 30s and the old 60s, and the Model A's and the GMC's, all hand cranked.
They didn't have self-starters yet.
Never had self-starters. No.
You'd have to heat the water up and put in the radiator, or the water they're using in them, alcohol water, and it'd boil away.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Build a fire on them. Take a can, take coals, build a fire, put it underneath the engine, let it heat up. In fact, I caught an engine on fire out here at Rika's Roadhouse out here at, on the Richardson. Yeah, Rika's Roadhouse.
That burned down because I didn't.
No, Rika's place is still out there. That's where the new bridge is. That, you know what? this side of Big Delta, you know, where you make the crossing there.
Oh, the big where Bird Mary was?
Yeah, well, you know, what's the name of the big bridge there?
This Delta side? Bridge?
The Delta Bridge. Yeah,
that's called Delta.
Yeah.
Big Delta District in there.
Yeah.
And it used to be a ferry in there.
A ferry in there, yeah. It was a cable ferry.
Mm-hmm.
It was a current.
And then Bert and Mary lived
there. Yeah, and Rika run the roadhouse there for years and years and years. In fact, she still lives in the old place out there. Mm-hmm. Rika Wallen, her name is.
Rika Wallen.
Rika Wallen. Mm-hmm. And she's still living there. She's very... I couldn't say her age now, but she's... way up in years.
Do you remember some of the people that lived in that area at that time? Do you remember any of the names?
Oh, not too much, no. See, I traveled on, I freighted on the trail is what I did. I carried supplies to the camps, different road camps, and hauled men back and forth, men that were quitting the job and men that they were sending out for replacements, and hauled oil and gas and food to the camps. And
how was the game? Plentiful in that time?
Game, I can remember when I used to start out and leave Chattanooga going towards Circle, up the Chattanooga River, right from the city of Chattanooga. At the time of the caribou season, the fall of the year, when the big herds would be going through there, they'd go through there for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks at a time, and the hillsides would be covered. In fact, they'd be so thick, it was just like an endless stream going through there. And going along the old road with your truck, Why, they'd be running alongside you on the lower side of the hill trying to cross the truck, beat you, you know, get ahead of you and then cross in front of you. And many a time I've had them, just hundreds of them, running right alongside the truck on the lower side of the road.
They're inclined to do that.
And stop, yeah, they want to come up the hill, see. And I'd stop, and this big band had just crossed the road ahead of me, and I'd just stop and look at them. If I'd have wanted to shoot a caribou, I wouldn't even have to point the gun, they were so thick. Nothing. Then in the spring of the year, you'd also have a run because the cows and the calves would be coming back through that same area there. And not like they are now, but I mean by the hundreds. Cows and calves. Not so much the bulls, but the cows and calves. The next spring. You know, you'd have your big herds crossing in the fall.
Twice a year.
Yeah, twice a year. Then in the spring, well, you'd get your cows and calves coming back through that same area. And,
How about the fur-bearing animals?
Oh, fur-bearing animals, well, I don't know. I'd say, well, I stayed here from 1926 to 19, the fall of 1927, my brother drowned in Fish Lake.
What was his name?
Donald Long. That's below Manly Hot Springs, between Manly Hot Springs and Tanana, where the American Creek Dredging Company was mining there.
What was that, a boating accident?
A dredge, yeah. He was freighting by boat from the Tanana River up Fish Creek and into Fish Lake over to the American Creek Landing. And he and my brother and one of the Enstrom brothers, Herbert Enstrom his name was, he was 27, my brother was 22 at the time they drowned. It was in September, right at freeze-up time, and they had this boat loaded with hay and coal and stuff because they had horses there at American Creek. And they tried to make this, I'd say Fish Lake is about between 2 and 3 miles wide and about the same length. It's a big lake. Fish Lake is a big lake. There was a roadhouse there on the lake for winter travel. A man by the name of Anderson operated the roadhouse, Charlie Anderson. He later hung himself in the roadhouse, committed suicide and hung himself. But they tried to make this crossing at night and a big wind was blowing and they got out from protection of the shore and they capsized. And the reason they knew where the boat capsized was because the coal, sacks of coal that was in the boat went right straight to the bottom. When they were dragging, well, they found the sacks of coal, so they knew where the boat capsized. They found the boat too, but the boat had been drifted, you know, from where it capsized. Well, there was about 100 men dragged the lake that fall for the bodies, but they never couldn't find them. So I went down there the next spring, the spring of 1928, I went down to Fish Lake, and with a brother of Herbert Enstrom that drowned with my brother. Gus Enstrom was his name. So Gus and I went down to the lake and we stayed there for a month. And we couldn't find the bodies. Then I left and my dad came up and he made a drag and he slept there one night. This sounds a little queer to me, but it's true. But my brother's voice came to my dad 3 times that night. Over near the Grass Island, Dad. Over near the Grass Island, Dad. 3 times, my father always said. Well, the next morning, they went over there. Another fellow rowed the boat. My dad sat in the stern, a rowboat. And they had this drag, and they had big hooks on it, and weighted drag, you know, to go to the bottom. A lot of big fish hooks on it. Went over near this Grass Island. The first thing was inside of a half an hour where they found Herbert Enstrom. Brought him to the surface. A little later on, where they brought my brother to the surface. And they were both just as perfect as the day they drowned because the water was so cold.
They preserved
them. In other words, they never floated to the surface or nothing. They just stayed down. There was no bloat or nothing. They were just like the day they drowned. And that was in late June that they were found. And my dad had a boat already on the Tanana River in the case that they did found them. They brought them up by gas boat to Tanana and they had a gas car waiting down at Nenana where they wired up or telephoned up for the gas car to be there when they arrived, you know, to get the bodies as quick as they could to Fairbanks. And they brought them in on in by gas car to Fairbanks and the funeral held was here and they're both buried in the city graveyard here, the old city graveyard here. And in 1928, I went to school here I didn't go that winter, the winter of, after my brother drowned. I went home and stayed home in Ruby with my folks. And in 1929 I was here, in 1930.
Which school was that you went to here?
I went to the old wooden school up here on Cushman Street, same location as the main school is in now. But it was a wooden school.
Wooden building.
Wooden building. And I worked as janitor in that school while I was going to school at $50 a month. And I also drove dogs here in the early day, not early day, but early, some early races that they had here of the present day racing that they have now. I'd say it was early days of their present day racing. Because I drove in the race between here and Chattanooga. That was 60 miles in one day. We didn't drive 20 and 30 miles a day in those days. We had one big run of 60 miles in one day. And then they also had the race from here to Livengood and back. And
that's 79 miles, isn't it?
I think it is to Livengood, yeah. Then they took a rest at Livengood, and that time was counted out, and then their return trip.
Just the driving time was counted in the time.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they had a forced time to rest their teams in Livengood. And
that old hotel that burnt here a couple of winters ago, that was in operation when you was in Livengood, wasn't it? The one that burned up recently, about 2 years ago.
The old hotel in Livengood? Oh, yeah, not at that time, you know, back in the 20s. Yeah, sure. This was in the late 20s, you see. Mm-hmm.
That hotel, yeah. I've been there many years,
yeah. But I went to school, trained dogs. I had this man that I was driving dogs for. I had 21 dogs. I trained dogs. I'd hitch them up after school, drive 30, 40 miles, come home, and then I'd go up and work and do my janitor work in the school, and I'd be doing that as late as 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. Then get up and go to school again the next morning, mm-hmm. Most of the time late. Because it was too much for me.
Some of these newer people that come into the country don't know what you went through.
Yeah, at that time. And the kids in those days going to school, well, we never had any such thing as buses like they have nowadays, cold weather buses and buses the year round. We walked. If it was 50 below, we walked in 50 below. If it was 60 below, why, we went to school in 60 below. They didn't close the school here in Fairbanks on account of cold weather. I never ever saw the day that in Fairbanks when I went to school, or in Ruby either when I was a little kid, that the school was closed on account of weather. We just put our parkies on and our moccasins on and muckalucks and two or three pair of socks and moose hide mittens and our parkies and went to school.
The winter clothing was mostly handmade here.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, your parkies and your boots were made by the natives, your muckalucks, reindeer, muckalucks. Maybe you might have moose hide bottoms, or they had outside the moccasins at that time too, made of horse hide. But that's the way us kids dressed when we were kids.
Did they always use fur caps?
You weren't dressed for looks, you were dressed for warmth in those days. People like going to Ruby in a dance, well, they didn't care whether they had a pair of overalls on, or whether they had a wool shirt on, or they'd even dance in a pair of shoe packs, whatever they had on. A man with a dress suit in those days was an oddity. Not very many men had a dress suit. If they did, well, they'd maybe only wear it once or twice a year, maybe Christmas and 4th of July.
A wedding, maybe.
Yeah, or a wedding or something like that. Yeah, suit of clothes last a man in those days.
20 years. You getting kind of tired, Tom?
Yeah.
Well, we'll take up from here a little later. Tom Long, and I want to thank you for this start. And this is Harry Hughes recording for Pioneer Igloo for Pioneers of Alaska. And this is the end of this portion of Tom Long's story for the moment, and he'll tell more a little later.